Today is August 12th, 2022. Issa Mujahid, proud owner of Sankofa Cafe in Bridgeport, Connecticut, joins us. Issa grew up in Bridgeport and is an active member of the Muslim community and an anti-racist activist. Issa, when and where were you born?
I was born on January 30th, 1978. I was born in Worcester, Massachusetts, during the Great Blizzard of 1978. My mother was born here and raised here in Bridgeport, and I believe she was a student at the time in Worcester when I was born. So shortly after I was born, my parents and I moved back to Bridgeport, where I was raised.
And where in Bridgeport did you live as a child?
I grew up on the North End, on Old Town Road, near Reservoir Avenue, right up the hill from Trumbull Gardens and on the Trumbull Line.
And tell us about your family, your parents' ethnicity and occupation. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yeah, I have one brother. He's a year younger than me. 13 months apart, and when we grew up, people thought we were twins, but we're not. My mother, like I said, was born and raised in Bridgeport. She had five siblings, and my father was born in Eufaula, Alabama, and he had, I believe, five or six siblings. And as they got older, my father was raised by his siblings. Both of his parents died when he was really young. And as they got older, one by one, they made their way up to Worcester. And so I grew up in Bridgeport, mostly around my mom's side of the family. You know, a lot of first cousins, there were about 20 of us in terms of first cousins. And my grandmother and grandfather had a house on Trumbull Ave, not far from where I lived. And then my aunt had a house on Trumbull Ave about a block or two away from my grandparents. And so a lot of us kind of lived close to each other. And we were really close growing up, all my cousins.
And what kind of job did your parents have?
I remember when I was really young, my mother being in nursing school when I was about three or four. She ended up becoming an RN, and my father worked in restaurant hospitality. At one point, my parents had like a fish fry kind of, takeout restaurant. On Reservoir Avenue. I remember that. I remember helping out there. I was pretty young though. And my mom ended up retiring from the state as an RN. And my father still works in hospitality.
And so your family came to Bridgeport because your grandmother grew up here?
No, my mother grew up here. My mother's parents grew up in the South. So my mother's mother grew up in Florida, and my mother's father grew up in Georgia. I don't know at what point they made their way to Bridgeport, before I was born, before my mother was born, obviously, because when they got here, she was born.
Do you know what brought them to Bridgeport?
I mean, I think they came up to Bridgeport at a time when a lot of black people were moving from the South to the North. And I don't know a lot of the stories of what life was like for my maternal grandparents growing up in the South. I've heard like maybe less than a handful of stories. Obviously, there was a lot of racism. My grandfather went to school up to the third grade The man I knew was very smart. He loved to read. He was self-educated in a lot of areas. You know, I know during that period known as the quote-unquote Great Migration, a lot of the reason that is given for Black people moving up to the North is in search of jobs, but what gets left out is a lot of them were leaving the terrorism of the Ku Klux Klan and Jim Crow, racism that was just allowed to, you know, proliferate. I don't know if that was the case for my grandparents or not, but they came up to the North around that same time. And my grandfather worked in factories here in Bridgeport. You know, that was a very industrial time. So I'm guessing, you know, 50s, I think they moved up here, maybe the 40s. My grandmother worked as domestic help in Connecticut suburbs prior to me being born. And I remember before she retired, she was working on a nurse's aide, and there was even a point where she and my mother were working in the same facilities, my mother being an RN and my grandmother being a nurse's aide.
And could you describe your childhood neighborhood? What was it like on the north end of Bridgeport?
So, like I said, I grew up on the Trumbull Line near on Old Town Road near Reservoir Avenue. I remember my mother bought the house. So there was a period we were living when she was in nursing school with my grandparents on Trumbull Avenue near Sylvan Street, so up the hill. And like I said, I had an aunt who lived down the street on Trumbull Ave, and then I had another aunt who lived not too far on Ortega Ave near Howland School. So we just ran around, you know, the neighborhood. We had some family in Trumbull Gardens and the Terrace. And then, so, you know, it was a different time, you know what I mean? Like, that was a time when kids were, like, actually outside riding their bikes. So we would be really just, like, all over the neighborhood. We'd ride our bikes to other neighborhoods. Sometimes we'd ride our bikes up to Trumbull Mall. Like, we were just, like, everywhere.
What kind of ethnic groups were in the neighborhood?
It was mostly a Black neighborhood. But I hung out mostly with my family, with my cousins. You know, they were my mother's siblings. They kind of had kids in groups together. So there were kind of groups of cousins who were like around the same age. And so, and we just, like I said, we just grew up tight. My grandparents' house was really kind of like the center of the family. And we were just kind of in and out of there. So most of my friends growing up were my family. And, you know, we had some other friends who were, you know, also like family. But mostly everybody was Black in the neighborhood. And then, you know, we had, you know, Puerto Rican friends in other neighborhoods who we go see, you know, on our bikes, on our skateboards. As I got a little bit older, one of my best friends lived in Stone Ridge. So I was hanging out in Stone Ridge a lot.
Where's Stone Ridge?
Stone Ridge is off of Reservoir Avenue, right behind Trumbull Gardens. So it's like a collective of co-op housing, like kind of condominium type things. So it's a community. It's a bunch of them. And yeah, you know, we'll be in a terrace too, playing basketball, you know. So it was, I mean, it wasn't all Black, it was mostly Black, at least, you know, my circle was. Definitely there were, you know, white folks who lived in the neighborhood, some Puerto Rican folks, but, you know, my memory is mostly Black.
And where did you go to school, and what was the ethnic racial makeup of the classrooms? And did the schools offer art, music, or industrial arts education?
Yeah, so when I started kindergarten, I went to High Horizons Magnet School. And I was there until sixth grade. and we did have industrial arts, we did have home ec. You know, I think those were introduced as you got a little bit older. Like I said, I only went up to sixth grade, so maybe I had like a year or two of that. I remember being in band. I played trumpet, and that I think started at like third grade. You know, I think lots of arts classes. There was a lot of offerings at the school. You know, I think back then you had to test to get into magnet schools. Now it's a lottery, I believe. And so, you know, there was a lot of emphasis on like enrichment and things like that. And, you know, the classes were
magnet schools are part of the public schools, right?
Yeah.
But they're more enhanced.
Well, I think back then it was kind of like, yeah, there was kind of, my understanding as a child, as a student, was that magnet schools offered some extra enrichment, some extra art, some extra this and extra that. And you had to test to get in. Now, my understanding, and I don't like know for sure because I'm no expert, is that magnet means across districts. And I think it was also the case there too, because mostly you get assigned the school that's in your district, right? But magnet schools, you can live anywhere in the city, and now almost, I think, anywhere in the like region. You don't even have to live in the same city to go to a magnet school. But I think it's still the case where magnet schools are considered to offer some extra enrichment, I believe. But usually when I hear about magnet schools, the emphasis is on the fact that they pull students from different districts and different towns. So I was there until sixth grade, and then my mother made a decision to put me in private school in Fairfield because even though, you know, I was a promising student and the school did offer a lot of enrichment, I think mostly because of the size of the classes, I was just kind of getting lost in the mix. So, you know, about 30 kids in the class, something like that on average. And so I was just kind of like, you know, I wasn't doing great. I wasn't failing, but I was just kind of like, eh, you know. And so in seventh grade, I started going to Fairfield Country Day in Fairfield. And there, you know.
Is that a religious school?
No. It's a private independent day school. It's not religious. It's just kind of out in the burbs. And it's, you know, the classes were much smaller. I think there were like 11 students. So to your other question, like High Horizons was like pretty diverse. It probably really reflected what the, you know, the racial and ethnic makeup of Bridgeport was at the time. Pretty good. I mean, again, I was a kid, but that's what it seemed like to me. At Fairfield Country Day, I was the only black kid in my class, pretty much as long as I was there. And so that school was a K-9 school. So I was there for 3 years, 7th, 8th, and 9th. But I did better because the class rooms were smaller. And I think just the way the school days were structured, there was just more time for independent study and to get one-on-one help. Like there were like study halls, like at one, or like maybe two throughout the day where you could just go find your teacher and ask for extra help, which, you know, that was just a new world to me. And I think the overall, as an all boys school too, I think the overall environment was, even though the academics were rigorous, it was also more laid back. That might seem counterintuitive, but that's just kind of how it was. And I think like that more relaxed approach allowed me anyway, to, you know, to just take more ownership of my learning. And then that made me like learning, and so I did better.
And as a child growing up in Bridgeport, did you or your family belong to any ethnic, social, or religious organizations?
So I was born Muslim. So we belong to Al-Aziz Islamic Center in terms of, you know, where we go for religious, congregational stuff. In Bridgeport, or sometimes we go to Hamlin and New Haven to a sibling mosque, you know, same kind of Muslim community in terms of theology. But that's pretty much it, you know. I remember my aunt, she was the first black private practice attorney, first black woman private practice attorney in the city. And I remember she used to get like recognition from like the NAACP and things like that. But I don't remember anyone being like very involved beyond that in the organization or other organizations. But, you know, my grandparents first joined the Nation of Islam before I was born. And then when I was born, they were in a community that was being led by Elijah Muhammad's son, Warthin Muhammad. And, you know, obviously the Nation of Islam had a lot of racial politics. And the community that I grew up in was more traditional in terms of like religious theology. But it coming out of the Nation of Islam, there was still an awareness of the role that race, the reality of race in America. And so while it wasn't front and center in the teachings, it was part of the heritage that this community grew out of. Because a lot of the members at one point were in the Nation, and a lot of them became Muslim for political reasons rather than religious reasons. And so my grandparents, a lot of the other elders, you know, would talk to us about the realities of race and about the realities of like our obligation to continue the struggle.
And what were some of the radio and TV programs you enjoyed as a child? And what was your favorite kind of music and dance? And also, what newspapers did your family read back then?
They read the Bridgeport Post, which is not a Connecticut Post. They read the Muslim Journal, which was like our community's newspaper. You know, Jet, Ebony, Essence. You know, depending on what age, you know, I liked Nickelodeon. You know, Nickelodeon came on the air while I was young. So it was like a new station, new network that I remember. And so that was like just for kids. And that was a big deal that there was like this new network that was just for kids. So Nickelodeon, you know, and then it got older, you know, MTV, BET. You know, I grew up listening to rap, R&B and soul, you know, through my mother and her sisters. But, you know, as a youngin', I was mostly into rap. I wanted to be a rapper at one point. And I used to write raps. You know, I started with poetry and then it became rap. And it was a good, you know, I felt it was a useful outlet to express myself. And as I got older, you know, there would be like house parties and things like that and ways for kids to kind of hang out and let some steam off.
Did you work after school? And if yes, please describe the job.
At one point, I had a job at Dutch's over on Boston Avenue. I don't know if that was my senior year or my junior year in high school. So I didn't mention earlier, so I went to Country Day until ninth grade, and then I ended up graduating from Fairfield Prep. I went to Greens Farms Academy for my 10th grade year, wasn't really feeling it. Then I went to Fairfield Prep for my junior and senior year. I worked at Dutch's. I don't know if I can remember any other, you know, I would do things like sell newspapers with my cousins, and but that wasn't really like my job. It was something I would help out with. But other than Dutchess, I can't really remember. Oh, I worked at, I remember Ruby Tuesday. That was my senior year. That was right before I left for college, as a busboy. And I remember making good money too in the mall, in the mall, Trumbull Mall. Yeah.
Where'd you go to college?
So I went to Morehouse in Atlanta for a semester. And, you know, I was really looking for something very specific.
What were you looking for?
Well, you know, at this point, you know, I'm 17, 18, and I'm really, like, trying to identify, like, who I am. And at this point, I had been going to these private schools for 5 years and a Jesuit school, Fairfield Prep, for the past 2 years, my junior and my senior year. So as a Black Muslim, I just felt some contradictions in who I saw myself to be and what my environment was. And I was really, and also, like I said, when I grew up in the Muslim community, hearing Black elders emphasize to us that we still have an obligation to our people to continue the struggle that began generations ago to free our people from racist oppression, things like that. And I was feeling like I wasn't, you know, moving from high school into adulthood. Like, I wasn't really prepared to do that. And so, and going to Morehouse, I was hoping, knowing that Dr. King went there, that it was going to be like this mecca of political activism and social consciousness. And it wasn't what I experienced. It was more like, you know, kind of like folks who just wanted to get rich, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and I can't knock it. They had their reasons for feeling like that was what their obligation was to be successful. And, but it was, I wasn't feeling it. And so I ended up joining the Army because I felt like the Army was going to be a good way to test me, to really find out who I am. And also, I felt like the lifestyle, the regimented lifestyle of the military was going to be useful for me in the future. And so, so I did that.
Where were you stationed in the Army?
So I was a medic. So after getting all my basic and advanced training, I was stationed at Fort Hood in Central Texas. And I had one deployment to Bosnia in the late 90s. So I joined the Army in 97. And in the winter between 98 and 99, our unit was deployed to Bosnia. So the war that had happened there, I believe the intense fighting was around 95. So by the time I got there, you know, this is talking about the former Yugoslavia, Bosnia, Serbia, Croatia. It was the U.S.'s role, as we were told, was more of a peacekeeping NATO, part of a NATO force. And so that was interesting, and then came home in spring of 98, and then, spring of 99, I went in the winter of 98, spring of 99, then in the fall of 99, my unit got orders to go to Kuwait. So this was after the first Gulf War. So Saddam Hussein was still in power, but the first Gulf War had happened already. So there was a U.S. presence in the Persian Gulf still, and in Kuwait. And so my unit got orders to go to Kuwait, and I was very conflicted for religious reasons. And so I had made a decision that I wasn't going to go. And so...
How'd you get out of it?
So I ended up... leaving, going AWOL from my base, and coming back to Bridgeport. And then my plan at the time, and this is, I know the Army is very different now, especially after 9/11, like it's a lot stricter, and I think even may even still be kind of in a combat posture. And this wasn't even a guarantee, but what soldiers would say is if you want to get out, you leave. If you like at your last resort, go AWOL. After, don't be gone 30 days or more, because at that point you become a deserter and the consequences and the process is different. So before you hit 29 or 30 days, you go to another base, not your home base, and turn yourself in. And at that point, they will basically just discharge you, because it's more of a headache to keep you and ship you back to your home base. And this is just like what's kind of like what soldiers would say, right? Like nobody knew. They heard stories that so-and-so did this or so on. But for me, it was just like I knew I wasn't going to go to Kuwait, no matter the consequences, I wasn't going. And so I went AWOL. And then some of my, superior officers, one that I had a good relationship with in particular, Black First Sergeant, called and we had a conversation. And, he convinced me to come back to my home base, to Fort Hood. So I did that and ended up going through a summary court-martial process proceeding, which is, you're not in court. It's not like the big court martial where you're actually in front of a judge, but you're kind of like, it's a real trial though, but it's in front of your immediate commanding officers. And so they're like the judge and the prosecutors, the people you know. And so I went through that. And as a result, ended up getting discharged. I had to go to the county jail for a little bit as part of my punishment. And ended up getting
discharged. Did you get your benefits or did?
So I lost any like educational benefits I would have gotten. I still get to use the VA for healthcare, and that's for life. I don't know about like home loans and things like that. I've never tried to access that, but my discharge does say misconduct on it, and that has some repercussions.
So when did you become the owner of Sankofa Cafe?
So I came home from the Army in 2000. And when I was there, I was sort of politically active already. Like I had a certain politics and a mindset that in a lot of ways was counter to the way they want their soldiers to be. I wasn't blindly patriotic because I'm a Black man and I know what America is. And also, so I was already kind of in that time being, getting the experience of like voicing my political dissent against the machine and dealing with the consequences of that. And there were a lot. And, all leading up to my court-martial. And so when I came home, I was actually, like, reinvigorated that I wanted to be, like, if I can get through that, then I can come home to civilian life and really get busy politically. And so that's when I found community organizing. And from, like, 2002 up to like now, I've always been involved in some form of community organizing and movement building. In 2016, I formed an organization called CT Corps, which the purpose was to have a Black led organization to like reclaim the lead on the agenda around racial justice priorities in the state, because even though there were, you know, Black leaders and advocates, you know, for me, seeing from behind the scenes and in the scenes, we weren't really leading, setting the agenda or the priorities around racial justice issues. And so that was really the mandate for CT Core. How, like, around 2 years in, I started really getting involved in food justice. And I saw food justice as really important, because its history going back, you know, talking about the land and who works the land really goes back to the founding of this nation. And you think about it beginning with land theft and slavery. And so when you think about...
When you say land theft, you mean...
From the Native Americans and attempted genocide and then... slavery, who works the land. So in that, you can, and then there are systems that come out of that. So there's systems of education or lack thereof in order to keep natives, non-Indian and Africans ignorant and enslaved, that still serve as the foundation of our public school system now. You know, there's a link there. There's a thread. Our food system, our agricultural system, obviously, our economic system, obviously, who has capital, who does not, who is a commodity, and who gets rich. As I was reflecting on all that, I also saw the potential for what we can be going forward around building new systems, right? So if there's opportunities, well, we have to create the opportunities to build new security, public safety systems, new economic systems, new health systems, new food systems, new education systems. And of all those, I felt like the food system, pun intended, was the low-hanging fruit. It was the easiest for us as regular people to do for ourselves. Like, to build a new public school system from the grassroots is very hard. It's not impossible, but it's hard, and we need to do it. But to get somewhere to grow food, whether it's a plot of land at a school or owned by the city or your backyard, and then sharing that food or selling that food at a farmer's market, creating some sort of supply chain or distribution network, creating, building restaurants from the ground up, grocery stores. Like, these are, this is possible, and this is a way you could build a food system from the grassroots that's community owned and controlled. And so I started, my activism started shifting in that way in terms of building institutions and systems. And Sankofa Cafe was the first of that, to be both one of the links in a community-run food chain, but also itself to be a community space where projects can be thought up and built and expanded upon, and a place where folks and like-minded folks in the community can meet and discuss and design and collaborate. And so we opened in 2020 in October.
In 2020.
Yeah, right in the middle of the pandemic. Yeah.
Oh, wow. And where is Sankofa Cafe located?
It's in the Arcade Mall in downtown Bridgeport.
On Main Street.
On Main Street, yeah.
Okay. And describe your living situation as a young adult, your marriage, and starting a family of your own.
Yep. So, when I got engaged, I actually moved to New Haven because that's where my fiance was living at the time. So I left Bridgeport. I was still working in Bridgeport. I was actually working for the city of Bridgeport in the health department as a lead paint inspector. But I moved to New Haven because my fiance was a community organizer, and it was like really important that she remained living in the community in which and where she was working. And so that was 2009. We got married the next year, and ended up having two kids. We're no longer together. I live in Hamden now, because it's just important to be close to where my ex lives for the sake of the kids. We're like 5 minutes apart from each other.
And who are your kids? Boys or girls?
Two girls. They're five and no, they're not, no, I'm wrong. They're 7 and 12 right now. And yeah, they're great.
And you share custody with your ex?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the way it should be. Describe your involvement with the Bridgeport Muslim community.
Like I said, I grew up, you know, I would hear stories, my grandparents, you know, when my mother was little, and they grew up in PT, they grew up in, you know, PT Barnum housing. And, you know, a lot of the folks that grew up with them, you know, I hear stories now that, like, you know, they were one of the first Muslim families, at least, you know, visible Muslim families, you know, that at least they knew about, if not, you know, in the city. So they really helped lay the foundation, for, at least for the Black Muslim community here in Bridgeport. You know, I hear stories about my grandfather taking Malcolm X, this is when they were in the Nation of Islam, around the state, you know, looking for locations to open up different mosques and things like that. Yeah. And,
wow.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's definitely, like, I love to hear that, stories like that. And even my aunt was telling me, I think this past Thanksgiving, last Thanksgiving, about how much Muhammad Ali loved my aunt, my mom's youngest sister, who was a baby when he'd come around. And you know, Muhammad Ali is just a very loving and gentle guy anyway. So obviously he would be good with babies. But just hearing the stories about how he was taken to this little baby, my aunt, and how much she loved him, and they would play around, it was like kind of crazy to think about. But yeah, they helped establish Muslim community here. Like I said, when I was born and growing up, I grew up in the Muslim American community, Muslim American Society, as it was called, under Wafdi Muhammad. And you know, there was a network of mosques, and you know, all over the country. But they were kind of like, the mosques really saw themselves as a network. So we go between Bridgeport and New Haven and Hartford and Springfield, Mass. You know, our Eid, the holidays, we, you know, they pick one and everyone would go to the one from all around the region. And it was just like, that's just kind of how we got down. So we kind of knew, it was a small community, but we kind of knew each other from all over the region. And as I got older, you know, I started realizing there were other mosques in Bridgeport. There was Masjid An-Nur, there was a mosque in campus at UB, and these were Muslims from all over the world. So I just kind of started going to those and kind of meeting Muslims from all over the world and how they practice their religion and how it's part of their culture and their history. And it also impacted my relationship to Islam as well.
Did the 9/11 2001 attack on the World Trade Center affect you or the Muslim community in Bridgeport?
Oh, definitely, definitely. So, I was in a pretty unique situation. So, I would say in terms of the Muslim, this was also around the time, well, right before I left for the army is when I started kind of going to these other mosques and kind of introducing myself and learning from Muslims from Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Africa. And then I left for the army. So it was like around my senior year when I was just like trying to get going through this kind of identity thing. So then I left for the army and came back in 2000. Then 9/11 happened a year later. And so I definitely did see, especially with Muslims who were immigrants, really afraid, because there was just kind of this immediate and allowed Islamophobia and attacks, and not just attacks, but like discrimination, you know, being pulled over, not getting jobs, you know, losing your job, just kind of things like just, and just being harassed, and them really not knowing how to deal with it. And being black is like, this is just part of like our American experience. Like, we know that there are these points where, you know, you become the other, justified or not, usually not justified, and all these attacks happen. Increased policing, increased harassment. Like, this was not new to black communities or black Muslims. And like I said, especially because in our community, a lot of black folks became Muslim because of the racism, because they felt like at the time that Nation of Islam offered an answer to deal with the racial politics. So we were in a very different position where we kind of knew what was up. And me, I had just come out of the army. So it was like, you're not going to tell me that I can't practice my religion, and I just came back from the freaking army. So I was emboldened to be even, especially because I saw my brothers and my sisters in fear, to be more out and to be more visible and to be more unapologetic about being Muslim. And so, and also it was just wrong the way what was happening. And not only that, like, I left the army because, one, my own morality around fighting other Muslims in a war that I thought was unjust, even though the first Gulf War had ended, you could tell something else was about to happen, because you were like, the bombing in Kenya had happened, the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi that, you know, they say was Osama bin Laden, the Black Hawk Down thing had already happened in Somalia. I had seen from inside that there were these incidents of military engagements in all these different Muslim regions, and I knew something was going to happen. So politically, I was also very anti-war and U.S. Invasion of Iraq. Obviously, I was against that. And I would say lastly, being stationed in Texas, George W. Bush was the governor when I was in Texas. So I was familiar with him and his whole, like, persona. And so just the way he kind of came in as a cowboy and, like, you know, this tough Texan, I was already familiar with that, and I wasn't impressed. I wasn't afraid. I knew there were, like, very real consequences, like people were disappearing and things, and people were losing their jobs and getting pulled over. But I felt like both my own experience, the experience of my ancestors, and just my political worldview kind of gave me a different lens and approach to that time that made me say, all right, I really got to confront this. And so I said, I came out already wanting to be politically active. And then that, when that happened, it poured even gasoline on that. And I really got even more active in terms of international politics and anti-war and immigrants' rights and things like that.
And going back to the Sankofa Cafe, what are your hours, and what kind of cafe is it? Like, what kind of food do you serve, and what else takes place in the cafe?
Sure. So right now I'm kind of closed for summer break, for like another week or two. So I should be open. I'll be open by September, if not the last week in August. And my hours are funny because I've kind of, part of the freedom of being self-employed is you can build your hours around some of your other obligations. I've built them around, obligations with my children and even, being able to go to Friday prayer. So right now I'm closed Sunday, Monday, 11 to 5 Tuesday, Wednesday, 11 to 8 Thursday, 3 to 8 on Friday after Friday prayer, and then 11 to 8 on Saturday. When I reopen after the summer break, that may change. So folks will just stay tuned. Our website is www.sankofa.cafe. I think one way I would describe our food is kind of like bar food slash street food,
What do you
and
mean
cafe
by
food.
street food?
Street food is kind of quick comfort food. So we have
Oh.
we have some barbecue. We have so we have a variety of wraps, baked potatoes, build your own baked potato, build your own nachos, build your own salad, build your own wraps, but with like different smoked meats or roasted vegetables. So we do smoked lamb, smoked chicken.
But no pork because you're Muslim.
No, and all the meats are halal. We do smoked wings. We have great coffee. We have all African origin coffees, single origin coffees. Single origin means they all come from one farm and one same bean. A lot of the coffees you buy in the store are blends of like different coffees. And that's okay. Sometimes people do that to kind of create a flavor or a signature flavor. But ours are single origin. And so yeah, coffee, smoothies, espresso drinks, and we have a variety of different events. So you came to our last book club meeting where we read and discussed The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. So we plan on having more of those coming up. We're in the arcade mall, so we work with some of the other arcade tenants to do a monthly pop-up where we create a space for other entrepreneurs and creatives who don't have a store to come and set up booths and sell their goods in the mall. And we do that every third Saturday. It's called Art and Soul. And then there's another pop-up that I don't directly organize that happens at the mall. It's called Artcade. So between those, there's like two pop-ups happening roughly every month. I've started a political party called the Real Party, Reparations, Equity, and Liberation Party. So there'll be some stuff happening around that and then around the cafe. We have a pay what you want daily offering where folks can come in and get something to eat, regardless of how much money that they have. And we want to expand that into like a whole menu of items. Right now it's usually one or two items, but it's available every day that we're open. We have other projects related to some of the movement building I was talking about earlier, building new systems and institutions, creating a community-based food system that are it's kind of too early to talk about now, but are connected to the cafe as well that we're working on.
We've been speaking with Issa Mujahid, Thank you, Issa, for coming today and telling us about growing up in Bridgeport and what it's like for the Muslim community and the anti-racist movement in Bridgeport, and also about your Sankofa Cafe.
Sure.
Yeah. Any closing thoughts?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, I feel like I've given my experience as a Muslim in Bridgeport and as an anti-racist activist and racial justice movement builder. You know, you might get a different perspective from someone else. But, you know, I feel like, you know, I would say there's like four things that really shaped who I am today. One is four or five things. One is growing up in my Muslim community, growing up in the family that I did, my the educational experience, my military experience, and growing up in the city is the fifth thing. Is really like shape. It's a tough city to grow up in, and it's a tough city to make sense of. But if you can do those things, if you can make sense of it, you get a very unique set of tools and perspectives that I think you can apply anywhere.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.